Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1964. The album is The Fiddler on the Roof Broadway soundtrack. The artist, Zero Mustel and others. My guest is Aileen Brosh McKenna. Thank you for being here.
Oh, I'm so happy.
At your own
here.
Office.
Yeah.
So, why did you pick this album? Let's just start there.
All right, first, I have questions. Has anyone ever picked this album?
No. No, we have done a lot of Zero stuff on here.
But have?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Got it. Okay, so is that why it's in the comedy category?
You know, that was my first... Here's the thing. I grab any sort of Broadway soundtrack, okay? Because, you know... Well, I mean, you
musical
know...
Musical comedy.
Exactly right, yeah. But, you know, any musical in general.
Right.
And so... And I was not as familiar with Fiddler on the Roof when I grabbed it.
Uh-huh.
However, you know, there's enough... comedy in the music, you know, despite the...
And in Zero. Uh-huh.
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. That's actually the
right.
biggest thing,
right.
is I love him to death.
Right. The performance is so great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I looked at the list that you had, and I thought every woman probably picks Free to Be You and Me.
It's been picked a few times, mostly by dudes, actually.
Oh, really?
Oddly enough, yes.
Mostly by dudes?
Yeah. Yeah, we did it literally 3 times in 1 month.
By dudes?
One...
That's so interesting.
It might have been. One was Kevin Allison from The State. I think they're all guys, yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah, it's unusual.
Well, I wore that one out.
Mm-hmm.
But the Fiddler one for me was a touchstone, and I thought was an interesting one because I never really thought about why it was so compelling to me because mm-hmm. when I listened to it, so I grew up in New Jersey. My mother is from France. She's actually, her parents were Algerian and Moroccan, but they moved to France.
Okay.
And she grew up there and she was hidden from her whole family went into hiding during the war.
Wow.
And my father is from Israel. And so we moved to New Jersey when I was 6 months old.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved to this house in like a very kind of pristine, bland New Jersey suburb.
Uh-huh.
And I grew up in two different towns, but one of them I lived in until I was 7 years old. And the Fiddler record for me, my obsession with the Fiddler record was before I moved.
Okay.
So it means it was before I was seven.
Sure.
So it means that was pre-1973,
mm-hmm.
74. And so that means I was obsessed with that record when I didn't know anything about what it meant.
Yeah.
At
yeah.
all.
Yeah.
I don't know how I got it. But I remember that it was not only something that I would listen to, but I would listen to obsessively. And my mother likes to tell the story about how I would lie in bed and the record would play mm-hmm. on one side. And then I would get up in the middle of the night in my nightgown and turn it over and mm-hmm. go back to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just do that until I was too tired to do it
wow.
anymore. And so when I listened to it again, because we were getting together, it was really interesting to me because, as I said, my parents are... from France and from Israel, and they're both Jewish, but they're not American Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And Fiddler on the Roof is very much a Jewish American artifact.
Yeah. Sure, sure.
And my parents don't understand Jewish American stuff.
Okay.
Like, they don't like Woody Allen.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand Sid Caesar. They don't understand that sort of all the people that surrounded that kind of more like a Mort Saul or
okay, sure.
they don't understand that kind of sense of humor because they weren't like the typical like Brooklyn Bronx Jewish immigrant.
Yeah.
I mean, especially if you're from France, that stuff makes no sense
to you.
Yeah. And Fiddler is kind of a pastiche because it's based on the singer stories and it's,
mm-hmm.
But it was sort of somewhat bolderized for an American audience
yeah.
and made somewhat more sentimental. And so I don't think that my parents selected it because they understood it. And so I have no idea how it ended up in our house. But it was such a big touchstone for me. It was the first musical that I fell in love with.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on in eighth grade, I was in the play.
Oh, so good.
I had one line.
Mm-hmm.
So I know the show really well. And... but it was interesting to me to listen to it and try and think about why it had been so compelling for me.
Mm-hmm.
The humor is a big part of it,
mm-hmm.
for sure, because, you know, it's a musical, but it's it is very classic Broadway, what I think of as very classic Broadway musical. And I think that one of the things that was so compelling to me was that it was this very specific kind of immigrant story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't really think, wow, you know, early 20th century shtetl, that's a hit, you know?
Right, of course.
Dealing with sort of the czar and, you know, some anti-Semitism.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the reasons it almost didn't get made half the time.
Right.
They were just saying it was too Jewish, which is...
And so I think, you know, a couple things kind of sprung to mind. One is, you know, for us doing our show, doing Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, one of the things that, you know, Rachel and I are from different generations and kind of different backgrounds, but one thing we have in common is we like to be as specific as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that's one of the reasons we set our show in West Covina, California, and we're super specific about the city and what it's like and the demographics of the city.
Yeah.
So, like, we go out of our way to cast the town so that it's, because that town is minority white. It's mostly Hispanic and Asian.
Okay, yeah.
So we go out of our way to cast it that way because she and I both love specificity.
Sure.
And we both believe that in specificity, you find your universality.
Yeah.
And I think Fiddler is a great example of that because there are just, you know, high schools all over the Midwest and the South or whatever who don't, you know, Jew is not part of their...
Right.
You know, it speaks to people all over. You don't have to be Jewish to appreciate it. It speaks to anyone. And I'm mm-hmm. sure there have been many, many productions of Fiddler on the Roof where there were no Jews for miles.
Sure, yeah.
So I think it was a great, it was of great interest to me that there was this cultural artifact that seemed so specific and so about a foreign culture, an immigrant culture, because it ends with them coming to America.
Yeah.
Which is not how the Singer stories end.
Right.
So I think that spoke to me. And then the other thing that really spoke to me is it's about this sort of heroic father
mm-hmm.
and his, you know, he's got sons because in the first number he talks about the sons,
yeah.
but it's about his daughters. I don't know if he has sons or maybe it's just the sons in the town. I think mm-hmm. in tradition it's the sons in the town.
Okay.
But Tevye only has daughters, I think.
Right.
But it was about a relationship between a man and his daughters and the sort of three different aspects of the different daughter characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I was and am very close to my dad, who is a bearded gentleman mm-hmm. with a lot of opinions. and so, who, you know, I had grown up sort of in conversation with my father about what were the right priorities and what are appropriate choices to make. And so I think that the father-daughter stuff always really spoke to me
sure.
and that it was, there's a lot of love and humor. And I remember that the songs, there's just two songs that made me cry then and make me cry now, and mm-hmm. that's Do You Love Me and Far From the Home I Love,
yeah.
you know, and they're just amazing songs about family and mm-hmm. parenting, and I don't think I really totally understood Do You Love Me when I was six or whatever, but mm-hmm. it certainly is more moving to me now than it was then.
Yeah.
But the idea of a daughter going to her father and saying, I have to go away, you know,
yeah.
I'm sure I thought when I was a young girl, like, oh, one day I'll have to have that conversation with my father as I move to Siberia with the man I love. I think it sounds, you know, you could see why people continue, you know, high schools continue to do that song, that show to this day. I mean, it's really about some very kind of classic American tropey stuff,
mm-hmm.
but based in this really, you know, specific era. So, I always, you know, that it's interesting because, you know, I think between Fiddler on the Roof and Free to Be You and Me, those mm-hmm. are the records that I grew up on. But you know, now that we're doing a musical and that we make a musical every week, I really have a different level of kind of appreciation for the storytelling through the music.
Yeah.
So I don't think I've listened to this record in a very long time, but it was great for me to go back and listen to it and just be struck again by sort of how well wrought it is.
Yeah.
And how well done it is.
The funny thing about it is that it is, it's a snapshot of Jewish culture in terms of like, it's a pop culture ideal of.
Yeah.
But it's also a snapshot of the 60s and then of a thing that I thought I knew through osmosis. You know, like, at least for me, my experience was, you know, it's referenced so often you think you know it.
Right.
And then you listen to it and I, you know, there's just, it's heavily emotional, And like you say, it's a little it's sentimental, but it's very beautiful. And
yeah,
there's something in it that I can't relate to specifically, but exactly what you said because of that specificity. Do you think your brain is ignoring the specificity just to find the core of the humanity because you don't understand
it? I think
the
thing about specificity, like on our show, on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, we have a character who's Filipino. Mm-hmm. And the reason he's Filipino is we designed the character to be Asian. Mm-hmm. So we named him Josh Chang. And then when we went to cast it, we auditioned Asian gentlemen from every background. Mm-hmm. And then when we cast Vincent Rodriguez and he's Filipino, so we went that direction and we, you know, really like went deep on, we go home and see his family and we cast actors who really, we really go home with the Filipino family and see what the Thanksgiving is like. And we're very, try to be very accurate with depicting that and the accents and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And you don't do something like that thinking like, you know, partly you want to make it accurate for people who might be Filipino, but sure. My argument would be that the more specific you make a world, it's actually more accessible to an audience than something that's vague.
Because of our traditions, we've kept our balance for many years. Here in Anatevka, we have our traditions for everything. How to eat, how to sleep, how to work, even how to wear clothes. For instance, we always keep our heads covered, and we wear these little prayer shawls. This shows our constant devotion to God. You may ask, how did this tradition get started? I'll tell you. I don't know, but it's a tradition. Because of our traditions, everyone here knows who he is and what God expects him to do.
Whole day and night must scramble for a living, feed a wife and children, say his daily prayers, and who has the right as master of the house to have the final word at home? The Papa!
Because we all know that there's specific kind of color and nuance in our own families and in our own backgrounds. So it's like if you're watching a thing about a Filipino family and they're eating dinuguan, or if you're watching a thing about a Jewish family and they're eating kosher, you know, or you're watching a thing about an Italian family and they're cooking the sauce just a particular way. Mm-hmm. Those things in your own culture, it stands in for something like, oh, we eat this really specific food and my aunt is obsessed with getting this food, this particular thing really right. And it could be marinara sauce and it could be blintzes and it could be, you know, kimchi. It could be anything.
Sure.
But I think things that are bland are more distancing because when you're trying to do like just basic America, you don't have those little details that feel real.
Sure. Yeah.
And so we try to do that on all levels. But I also, you know, before I did Crazy Ex, I did a lot of movies that were set in a workplace. Mm-hmm. And I always did a ton of research so that I could really like accurately capture the workplace. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because with Devil Wears Prada, people didn't want to talk to me because the rap was that Anna Wintour didn't like the book, and Anna Wintour is the most powerful person in fashion. Mm-hmm. So nobody wanted to talk to me on the record about anything to do with working at the Premier Fashion Magazine.
Wow.
So I had to find people who would talk to me off the record about it. Which now, 10 years later, it seems like, you know, that book, that movie now seems like a veneration of those things. Mm-hmm. So it seems funny to me that it was so controversial. And then when I did a movie called Morning Glory, mm-hmm. which was set in a newsroom, and Morley Schaefer and Bob Schieffer did cameos in it. Mm-hmm. And I remember they were walking down the street and I was like so tickled because I grew up watching CBS with my dad, CBS News with my dad, mm-hmm. which is like another sort of tri-state Jewish institution, you know, the New York Times and CBS News. Mm-hmm. And they walked towards me and Bob Schieffer said, "What newsroom did you work in?" And I said, "I've never worked in a newsroom." Wow. And they were shocked because they were Morley Schaefer. I said Morley Schaefer. It's Morley Schaefer.
Oh, right. Yeah.
They were shocked because they thought that, you know, we had nailed like the details. Jeez. So that's always, I think it's always a good idea to go for the specific.
Yeah.
I mean, Fiddler's super specific about like the tailor, mm-hmm. and you know, his exact dreams to Tevye about what he wants to do, and he wants to study the Bible all day, study mm-hmm. Torah all day, mm-hmm. and so I think those really specific details, it's just good writing.
I think the assumption is, and it's obviously a mistake, is that specificity is just going to turn people off and scare them, which is interesting. So, for sure, there are some people like that because they don't want anything outside their own world. But I mean, this is also, this comes out at a period where Alan Sherman was the biggest thing in comedy music. And we just covered, oddly enough, after 5 years, Alan Sherman for the first time.
Oh,
the other
wow.
day. And it hasn't come out yet. It was with the voice of Teddy Ruxpin, of all people. And it was a lot of fun. And that's just, it's so specific. It's exactly the same thing. It's so Jewish.
That's Jewish.
All it is.
Yeah. And I mean, I think Alan Sherman is more Jewish than Fiddler, because Fiddler is, first of all, filtered through some goyim.
Sure.
For sure.
Sure.
And also was designed to be for a goy audience.
Of course. Yeah.
And succeeds smashingly in that sense. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of it as having sort of like a, I know it's 1964, but it has kind of a middlebrow 50s kind of feel to it, mm-hmm. to me, where it's like it's a little bit of a homogenized, like they're Jews but they're not too Jewy,
right,
you know,
right.
It's like it's not too scary. The other thing I think is really interesting about it is that it's always attracted, like, a big star will play Tevye,
yes.
and then become famous for playing Tevye and then play Tevye for a million years, because
yeah.
Zero did that, and then Tuple did that, mm-hmm. and then the third guy is the name of the guy who also plays him. It's going to come to me. There's another guy who famously plays Tevye.
Okay.
And I know his son, too. It's going to come to me. But it becomes like a signature role. So I think that's another thing that's really compelling about it, is that you get to see this big star in this, you know, kind of doing this.
Yeah. And Zero is huge on so many levels. Just like, he's such a big actor. Like, all the lines, they just come out. Like, that was the delight of turning it on for the first time
right.
for me. Because all I ever think of is the producers or, you know, anything like that. Where he's just so, but also, I forget how emotional and, like, small he can be if he tries.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and a great way of selling a song. I mean, a great way of bringing a song across. And a lot of the other performers in the show have more what we think of as traditional Broadway chops.
Mm-hmm.
But he really sells a song in an amazing way. And it's funny, I have never really listened to subsequent... Bekel. Theodore Bekel.
Ah, okay.
I've never really listened to subsequent cast albums because this one is baked into my brain from
yeah.
such an early age.
Sure. I mean, it's it's so easy for me to find. I find it almost every time I go shopping for records. And I'd always wondered, I think it's got the same kind of appeal that, like, a lot of the other common records I find, like a First Family or whatever, which is interesting because that's, like, so white and American
right.
and so not Jewish, but that we've got all these, you know, they're just every once in a while, that's one of the little keystones you'll find
right.
in a pile of records. I think I have two copies of it by accident. Do you have a favorite, track on the album?
I mean, it's a killer thing. Far From the Home I Love is just like,
yeah.
it's so killer. And when we did the play in high school, and my best friend's sister played the part, Carolyn Chow. And, you know, the funniness of being in high school and sort of having a 15-year-old Chinese-American girl singing this, you know, the oldest daughter to the 16-year-old kid who's playing Tevye. And it's funny, one of my closest, dearest friends from childhood, we met during that play. I played the sister who has one line,
mm-hmm.
and he played one of the Russian guys who dances and says, like, the weirdly, overly benevolent Russian character,
mm-hmm.
and who does the dance. So it's also sort of, like, baked into it. But anyway, Carolyn Chow sang that song, and she was like, you know how every high school has, like, the person who's, like, the great singer?
Yeah.
And she was the great singer, and she sang that song and crushed it.
It's awesome. So how long, I mean, besides your interest in this, how long have you been a musical person? I mean, have you been...
I haven't really. It's funny because obviously Rachel Bloom, who I do the show with, she majored in musical theater.
Mm-hmm.
She knows every musical ever made.
Mm-hmm.
I always joke with her because she's in her late 20s, and you would think that her iPod would have something on it that was contemporary, but she really doesn't. Only has show tunes on there.
Mm-hmm.
She kind of pretends that she's interested in pop music, but she really doesn't know anything about it. Like, I'm sure I know more about Top 40 than she does. But I only really know the musicals that I did in high school.
Okay.
I also, like, I think it's been for the good of our show that I'm not a generally, like, I don't generally get excited about musical numbers just mm-hmm. because they're musical numbers.
Sure.
Where some people do. Like, some people are just excited that something is a musical, and they'll sure. overlook tremendous flaws just for that.
That would be me, yeah.
But I don't, and I'm not a connoisseur in that way. And so we have three songwriters on the show. Rachel really comes from musical theater background. Adam Schlesinger, who writes the songs with Rachel and produces all the tracks, mm-hmm. comes from a pop band from Fountains of Wayne.
Oh, okay.
But he also did the music for Cry Baby on Broadway.
Oh, right.
And has written a bunch of songs for the Tony Awards. And so mm-hmm. he's kind of does everything, although he's basically a pop person. And then Jack Dolgen, who also is one yeah. of our songwriters, was in a band, and so he comes kind of from the pop idiom. And I know the least about music, obviously, than the three of them. And because I sort of, you know, facilitate the songwriting process and getting songs into our show, I represent the person who doesn't really know that much about music, but is saying, hey, I don't understand this, or this is not accessible to me,
right.
or this is a kind of an arcane... So that's sort of the purpose that I serve. And I'll often say to them, look, this is just a monkey talking, but as a monkey, I don't really understand what we're going for here.
Yeah.
Like, or as a monkey, I just want this to be faster paced, or
right.
that's the term that I use for the non-music professional. I have two roles with the music. I'm the monkey who says, hey, could this be more upbeat, or could this be slower, or could this be funner, or, you know, things that are not... And then I also am the song doula. Like, I can't write a song myself, but I just walk around being like, guys, you can do it. You're ready. Just let it out. I got them. I'm ready. Because we did, you know, in our first season, we did 49 pieces of music,
jeez.
Which is just, it's ill-advised. But to get all those pieces, you know, ready in the script, ready to be shot, you know, and I'm very much like a person who wants the production of things to be well in advance and be super prepared, because even when you are, there's always last minute things. So, you know, there were a few days where I just would make everybody go to my house and mm-hmm. I would make scrambled eggs and I would just sort of stand over there and wait for the babies to pop out.
I wonder if Yenta the matchmaker found a husband for you.
Oh, Yenta!
Well, somebody has to arrange the matches. Young people can't decide these things themselves.
She might bring someone wonderful.
Someone interesting.
And well off.
And important. Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a find, catch me a catch. Matchmaker, matchmaker, look through your book and make me a perfect match.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, I'll bring the veil. You bring the groom, slender and pale. Bring me your ring, for I'm longing to be the envy of all I see.
For Papa, make him a scholar.
For Mama, make him rich as a king. For me, well, I wouldn't holler if he were as handsome as anything.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a find, catch me a catch. Night after night in the dark I'm alone. So find me a match of my own.
You know, it's an interesting thing because you have to do with the show. It's my favorite show on TV right now.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
And Rachel's a friend of the show. Show's Jack, actually. They've both done the show a few times. And it's based on her previous work,
yeah,
and based on, you know, from what I've seen in the show, obviously a lot of it is not necessarily pastiche but homage. It's a lot of that
yes.
stuff. I'm using words that everybody
yeah.
uses, but so you've got to deal with that, but also that, like you said, that flavor of specificity.
Yeah.
So I think
so. We don't do direct parodies, right? So
yeah,
we don't do
yeah.
Weird Al stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's interesting is, the songwriters definitely work in genres.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to have a distinctly recognizable genre.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't, then it's hard for them kind of to lock in on the songs.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, we've done songs which were kind of more direct parodies of other things,
mm-hmm.
like that refer to a particular artist or a group of artists.
Okay, sure.
And then we've done songs like I'm a Good Person, which is just like, it's a pop song.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. it was sort of going to be like an Avril Lavigne song, and then it was sort of going to be like Happy, and then it was sort of going to be like a Taylor Swift song.
Right.
And it's sort of all those things, but it's sort of none of those things.
Mm-hmm.
whereas some of our stuff is more like directly, and because we have a comedy show and not I mean we're not a musical in the sense of like, you know, it's not a drama musical. It's not Hamilton. Right. It's not whatever it is. It's not Cats. It's a music. It's a comedy. Yeah. And so they're comedy sketches. I mean, in a lot of ways, they're more like what Key and Peele is doing. They're more sketch based.
Sure, yeah, okay.
So they have to be really specific, but they also always have to be funny. Mm-hmm. So they always have to be based on like a strong central joke. So that's different from a traditional musical where you just do a song where somebody says, I want to be a mermaid. I want to fly. Yeah. You know, ours always has to have a concept or a joke. And, you know, the other interesting thing about Rachel, Adam, and Jack is that they all three have other full-time jobs in our show. Because Rachel's the lead of the show. Mm-hmm. Adam is not only, you know, Adam is producing all the music, and Jack is a writer in the writer's room.
Yeah.
So they all have separate, and I'm, you know, running stuff. And so the fact that everybody who works on the songs is also doing something else is an amazingly weird thing that happened, but it's a testament really to the fact that once they have the idea, they're very fast. Mm-hmm. And then once we have the idea, Adam and Steven, who produce the music, just like they turn in stuff that's so unbelievably good that doesn't really need a lot of adjustments.
Sure. Yeah. If I could talk about the show all day, but I guess we should probably go back to Fiddler for a little bit. Mm. Is there anything? So you said you're not a big musical fan necessarily, but mm-hmm. this one for sure.
Yeah.
What about it after re-listening to it? Is there something specific still resonating? Unless we've already talked about it.
Yeah, I feel about musicals the way I feel about dogs and people, which mm-hmm. is like I don't understand people who are like, I'm a dog person. I'm like, I like specific dogs. Mm-hmm. Some dogs I'm like grossed out by and not attracted to.
Sure.
I feel that way about people. I feel mm-hmm. that way about children. Mm-hmm. You know, children are generally cute, but I've definitely been around kids where I'm like, you know what? Not for me. Glad I didn't get that one. And I feel that way about people. Like, I'm just like that as a person. Like, I'm too specific to be like, oh, I'm excited about every musical. And the thing is, musicals can be quite corny. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing we come up against on the show, is sort of how to do it in a contemporary idiom so it doesn't seem... We do retro stuff, but so that it seems like retro stuff done with a contemporary sensibility. Mm-hmm. The thing about Fiddler is I just think that, you know, it transcends those things, but particularly for me because of... You know, it was interesting to me that the Judaism that people were talking about, Judaism and being Jewish, you know, as I said, my parents had moved from, you know, wildly. My father is actually, his mother was from Poland and moved to Israel in the early 20s.
Okay.
And so she was like a pioneer, a Zionist. Mm-hmm. And almost all of her family stayed in Poland, and they all perished.
Wow.
And my father's father was Russian, but they had come to live in Israel at the late 1800s. They're very, 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 very early pioneers. Mm-hmm. So he's really Israeli. And my mother is from Moroccan Algerian Jews, so she's from North African Jews, which is, there's a long, long tradition. And then she moved to France, so... like the Jewishness is so embedded in my family for so many centuries on both sides. And then you take those people with this incredibly rich cultural heritage and you plop them into the suburbs where there weren't a lot of Jewish families. And the ones that we were, there was such a strong value placed on not seeming different.
Okay.
You know, like I was sort of dark hair, dark eyes, hairy arms. You know, all I wanted to do was be blonde and have cute freckles. Mm-hmm. And so I think... Partly it was like and because my parents, you know, not uncommon, my mother being a Holocaust survivor and my dad being a veteran of the Israeli Arab Wars, like they never talked about those things.
Sure.
And they're both not religious. My mother's very lightly, my father not at all.
Okay.
So I think that I was also fascinated by the presence of religion in that,
okay,
in
sure.
that show,
yeah.
which you don't get from, you know, Cats. So I think I was fascinated by that, and then I think I was very, very compelled by the father-daughter relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, but I really, in those days, you know, the 70s were like a very bland time culturally,
okay.
weirdly. So like, what I had to look at were Partridge Family, Brady Bunch, and I just didn't recognize, you know, my name is a French name, my brother's name is Avi, which is an Israeli name. Like, mm-hmm. we just, and my parents are, have, speak with thick accents and don't understand any cultural references and don't understand Count Chocula and don't understand Halloween and don't understand. So I felt very foreign, and I think this was like a foreign thing that also felt like American and understandable to me, and maybe held the promise of some assimilation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a huge part of it. And it also explains my deep obsession with Cher, who was, you know, a dark-skinned, dark-haired. At the time, her face was much more asymmetrical. You know, probably had some hairy arms. She was a cultural icon in the 70s that didn't look like Florence Henderson.
Sure, yeah.
And so I think a lot of the, you know, even though Fiddler is not really, you know, it's not Elie Wiesel. I mean, it's not like a, you know, a deeply authentic piece of Jewish writing. But it speaks to those themes, and I think that was very compelling to me in a world where I didn't quite understand, you know, with my peer group, I just longed for Presbyterianness, you know. I just longed for it. Like, at worst, I would have preferred to be Italian. Like, at least that was something people understood. It was just hard. It was like a hard, you know, until I really, you know, I guess when I got to college, there were a lot of Jews. It was really, you know, it was a, you know, it was definitely suburban New Jersey. It was not a hotbed of the Jewish solidarity movement.
Yeah, it's interesting to talk about it this way, because I'm not Jewish, but to understand, to hear from you something that doesn't feel Jewish, but you know is Jewish.
Right.
That's very interesting to me.
Well, like in high school, I was in Godspell. Uh-huh. I don't know what any of that means.
yeah.
Literally. Yeah, I'm like singing songs about Judas Iscariot. I have no, to this day, no clue what any of those references are.
Right.
I don't know any of the gospel stories or whatever. But those are great songs, and I was happy to embrace that. But I don't think that would ever have the same kind of meaning as it would for somebody who grew up on those kinds of stories.
Sure.
And all of the musicals that I really love are really... I have noticed that the ones I really like tend to be nonfiction ones, mm-hmm. strangely. Like, I love Gypsy. That's a real big favorite of mine, and that really is based on a memoir.
Yeah.
I love Jersey Boys. I've seen that 5 times.
Sure.
And that's, to me, is basically like a great Scorsese movie with that great music. I love Hamilton. I mean, I'm obsessed with Hamilton. So I think I tend to gravitate towards the ones that are more like earthbound.
Sure.
And I'm less into the ones that, you know, like, I don't think I have a favorite musical that has a dream ballet in it. But Rachel certainly does.
Sure, of course. Yeah, that might be the hardest part.
Like, Fantasia to me is like, what's happening? I'm really tired and bored. I don't get it.
Yeah. No,
and I also don't resonate with Disney musicals. I have I did not grow up on princess fantasies. I find them dopey.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Rachel and I met because she did that video, What If Disney Princesses Were Historically Accurate, which was a great spoof of Disney princesses, and I thought a great sarcastic spoof of Disney princesses, which again, a lot of girls, women, really are obsessed with those.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was a little old for them when they started rolling in.
Sure.
But I also find those female characters, by and large, very insipid.
Of course.
And like, idealized looks-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's just get, like, everybody's so wasp-waist and fabulous, you know?
True. Yeah.
Like the always the ugly stepsisters in like in Cinderella, I'm like, I don't know, she's kind of cute, like, looks okay to me.
Well, yeah.
You know, she's supposed to be the hideous one.
Sure.
You know?
Well, can we talk about that then on the show? Like, what? Just the idea of portraying people in, again, if not realistic at all times, specific, but that specificity does make them seem more realistic, at least.
What do you mean? The characters in the show?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, none of the, again, any time there's something that even remotely approaches the stereotype of perfection, it's usually in a fantasy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, we're always spoofing. I mean, particularly the show, I think, is very most interested in how women are sold. You know, what's interesting is that Rachel, you know, having studied musical theater, and I came from a background of writing romantic comedies, or if they weren't actual romantic comedies, they were sort of in that tone.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, I tried very hard in the way that I wrote those things to kind of, like, Devil Wears Prada and Morning Glory and are not really romantic comedies, mm-hmm. In that they're not in the, about the pursuit of a man.
Sure.
And that was sort of a radical, those were sort of radical ideas. Like, I was always amazed that in Prada they let me end it with her the way it was. Like, mm-hmm. there's no kind of happy ending to that love story.
Right.
And Morning Glory is about a love story. It's a platonic work romance between a young woman and an older man. I don't think that love is particularly interesting as an end goal. I don't. I think it's a strange thing that we market that to people as some great goal in life when most of us, you know, half of, at least half of us grew up in families where that did obviously did not work.
Of course, yeah.
But we have such a staunch belief in the, like, the transformative ideas of romantic love, and it's one of the most kind of stunting and damaging things that we do to girls.
Mm-hmm.
And so really kind of unpacking that and kind of the hypocrisy of what women are expected to do,
yeah.
and expected to think about and expected to be worried about, is, that's a huge preoccupation for Rachel and I.
If I were a rich man, all day long I'd biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a bitty, bitty rich, yidle-diddle-diddle-diddle man, I see my wife, my Goldie, looking like a rich man's wife with a proper double chin, supervising meals to our heart's delight. I see her putting her heads and strutting like a peacock. Oh, what a happy mood she's in. Screaming at the servants day and night.
And it's funny because we don't, it's, you know, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is a spoof of a romantic comedy as much as anything else. And it's funny to me when people are like, oh, Team Greg, Team Josh, this guy, that guy. And I think we've made it clear, and I think the show's made it clear, that it's not about this guy or that guy, that it's about her own personal struggle.
Right.
But so much of the music is about the sort of the dumb things that women are told and sold, and the, you know, the obsession with appearance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a song, Put Yourself First, but it's Put Yourself First in a sexy way, because there's always this sense of, like, you know, I'm getting my shit together. I'm putting on a push-up bra and high heels and a lot of makeup. Well, who are you doing that for?
Right.
Is that for, like, because if that's for you, you'd be wearing sweats and mm-hmm. putting her in a ponytail.
Uh-huh.
And maybe at the most you'd wash your face. But, you know, it's so, a lot of the show is about these, you know, I really think that the list of things, you know, men can really be successful and homely and
mm-hmm.
nobody thinks twice about it.
Mm-hmm.
But for a woman, you're really expected to be at this level of, you know, being Beyonce and Sheryl Sandberg and, you know, Elizabeth Warren. And you're supposed to be a combination of these things. You're
yeah.
never really able to just be the one thing
sure.
because you're always supposed to, like, be cute,
yeah.
you know, at the same yeah. time. Michelle Obama's like an amazing human being plus cute,
right.
you know? And so we're always, you know, we never, I think if the show is about anything, it's sort of an investigation of, like, the roles that women are shoved into.
Yeah.
And the fact that being a love object and pursuing love is so prioritized in the culture,
yeah.
especially for women and especially for young girls.
For sure.
And especially in pop songs and, you know, and music and, you know, you just grow up as a young girl longing for romance, weirdly, even before you're pubescent. It's
yeah.
just really like, it's, and I, you know, one of the things we spoof in the show, there's this weird daddy-daughter
yes.
stuff.
I knew that's where you were going.
It's very weird. Like, if you had a mother-son dance and there was a, like, and the mother was bringing him a corsage and it had romantic overtones to it, it would be so gross and creepy.
Yeah.
But I'm always seeing my friends posting, like, daddy-daughter dance, and she has a corsage, and
mm-hmm.
the dad's in a suit, and she's in a prom gown, and
yeah,
very, very, very strange. So
somehow Fiddler doesn't cross that line, though. Fiddler's got this
very sweet,
right?
Yeah, the father-daughter thing in there is very sweet, and he's kind of grumpy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the other thing, too, is, like, the way it picks up, Fiddler picks apart little pieces of like little pieces of love or ideas of love. Like yeah. Matchmaker is just yeah. just like this one little segment or idea related to love, like a mini essay on just yeah. a part.
A lot of that show is about love, and it's about the marriage of an arranged marriage, and mm-hmm. And definitely the filial love. And I mean the what do you do if it's filial? What if it's a daughter? What's it called? Sororial.
I'll let you handle this.
And then obviously all the girls fall in love with somebody and go away with yeah. you know, a poor man and a radical, political radical, whatever sure. that meant in the day. So yeah, it's definitely interested in themes of love. I mean, look, some of this stuff is not to be biologically deterministic, but you know, we're led around by our wombs. You know, we often say men are led around by their dicks, but women are also led around by their wombs. You know, love is designed to get you to reproduce.
Yeah.
That's why it exists, romantic mm-hmm. love. And so that is so strong, that drive to get your DNA with someone else's DNA mm-hmm. is so powerful that it overtakes your intelligence.
Sure.
And that's why we all have done stupid, crazy things for romantic relationships. And I think that's why what in the show resonated with us was this idea of, like, even a super smart person like Rebecca Bunch, who's so highly overeducated, is still driven by her, you know, it's still her, you know, uterus is out in the wild calling out for Josh's DNA. So, yeah, we are, you know, that's our, but I think our take on love is never po-faced. It's never straight up.
Yeah. One of the things about the show that works so well for me is that the fact that I relate so well to her,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that made me very happy when I was rooting for it anyway.
Right.
I was a fan of hers.
Right.
But then I'm like, okay, this had better be good. You yeah. have to think sure. that, because otherwise you're just going to love it for the wrong reasons. And that is the biggest thing to me.
You know,
like,
that's an interesting thing about
her.
Rachel.
Yeah.
Like, she has a really, men love Rachel, and it's not just because her boobs are so fantastic. Her sense of humor,
yeah.
she basically has a sense of humor of a 13-year-old boy.
Sure.
And so I think that really, like, men really understand that.
Mm-hmm.
She's really get her sensibilities, like, very much like a sketch thing. And I think she doesn't have, like, a soft, girly sense of humor. She
sure.
definitely has a more, like, aggressive comedy, alt comedy sense of humor. I think
mm-hmm.
men really relate to that.
Yeah.
And I think for women correctly intuit that Rachel is not a diva or a mean girl or any of those things. It's
right.
so funny because you can dress her up and she can look like the most gorgeous hot starlet.
Mm-hmm.
But I think women correctly intuit that she's actually this, like, you know, kind of regular girl in jeans and a big t-shirt who, like, wearing flip-flops, who can't do her own makeup.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it's so funny to me that no matter how much you glamorize her, women always understand that she is that. Like, she can look like that, but
mm-hmm.
she isn't that. She
yeah.
really is just, like, a nerdy writer.
Yeah.
And so I think it's incredibly, like, that was one of the things I first responded to about her, is, like, she is incredibly beautiful, but she's always playing against that.
Yeah.
And not in a kind of angry way, but in a just a very natural way that's not a part of her identity, really.
The interesting thing too, especially about her early stuff online,
mm-hmm.
Is that, like, she was at the very least in control of how her sexuality was used
yeah.
on camera.
Right.
And I think that was huge to it.
Because
yeah. otherwise, if somebody else had been directing her the whole way, telling her how to dress,
right.
it would
yeah,
have
she,
not
I mean,
worked.
Obviously, a lot of her stuff deals with sexual content.
Sure.
But she does, you know, she refers to her genre of music videos as boner killers.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so it's like she's kind of, if you get aroused, she's sort of shaming you for being aroused.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of the genre she works in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's obvious. That's a safe place for women. And I think men also find it incredibly funny.
Oh,
we
yeah.
do it. We have a lot of men really get it.
Yeah.
Really get the show.
It's, well, I mean, any good comedy is a good shock to the senses like that. And there's no greater shock than exactly that. The idea
yeah.
of a boner killer. Just
but she
fantastic
has a
term.
Sweet benevolence and joyfulness to her comedy also, Rachel does.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why the very first time we met, she and I talked about Carol Burnett. And
yeah.
she reminds me a lot of Carol Burnett
mm-hmm.
because she has that willingness to kind of do anything for a joke.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a kind of a sweetness. And also what Carol always had was, like, you could always feel Carol's love for her scene partners.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can feel that with Rachel too. Like, she's so excited for other people around her to be funny and for them to be funny together and for her to make them funnier. So Carol and Lucy, who also, you know, Lucille Ball also has a similar kind of like, she was very beautiful, but she's always willing to look silly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Rachel's comedy is just so accessible.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Actually, you reminding me, I saw this photo spread of Carol Burnett from mid-60s, and that's she's arm wrestling Rod Serling and beating him, and that kind of makes me think of, yeah, it's very much her.
Yeah.
Just a very real person.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're nearing the end of this, so I want to sort of, first of all, have you say why listen to this album if you've never heard it before.
Oh, my God. Well, this is like one of the ultimate you'll laugh, you'll cry. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's quite funny. You'll definitely cry.
Yeah.
And I think it is like it's a peek into kind of like contemporary American, you know, certainly musical, but definitely contemporary American storytelling, and sort of it's wonderfully constructed. So from a craft standpoint, it's beautifully made. The story is really well constructed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you haven't heard it since your sixth grade musical, I think it's worth firing up and seeing that there's kind of more there.
Yeah. And this podcast always recommends Zero Mostel highly, because mm-hmm. that voice is just... I have an album of him singing these songs, these ridiculous love songs and other ways. He's just... But he goes 10... He's at 11 the whole time, just yelling, singing. It's fantastic. We covered that one on here once. Okay, so... I don't know when this is going to come out. However, I can put it out if there's anything urgently important that you want to promote. Otherwise, I can wait a bit. But is there anything coming
out? Well, we are doing the upfronts in May and announcing our second season, kind mm-hmm. of. And then
season one will start running again during the summer break.
Yeah,
that'll run.
Season one, we don't know yet. So season one's hopefully going to be up on Netflix at some point.
Good,
that's what we're hoping for, but we don't have a definite date.
Okay,
for that.
Yeah. All right. How about online? Where can people find you and your other work?
I am not. I do not have an online presence. They can find Rachel on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
She's on Instagram at Rachel Does Stuff, and she's on. You can find her on Twitter, Rachel Bloom.
Mm-hmm.
The show we were so busy getting the show out that we don't have like the clever Twitter feeds for all mm-hmm. our characters that mm-hmm. we should. But
sure, sure.
But Crazy Ex-Girlfriend has a Facebook page and Instagram and Twitter. And
at @CW_CrazyXGF.
Yeah. And I am just, I'm in the shadows.
Good.
Yeah.
Smart. That's good stuff. I'm just very happy that the show got, it took a single episode for people to realize they were complaining about the title for the wrong reasons and didn't understand it.
You know? Well, it's so funny because it would never occur to us that we would ever do it not ironically.
Right.
So.
Well.
And it's funny because a lot of the people who hated it refer to it as My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And if you're thinking of it as My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, then I understand why you hate it.
Yeah.
Because you think it's about a male complaining about a crazy woman.
Yes. Yeah.
But it wouldn't, because it never occurred to us, like, truly we were surprised that people didn't like, that people had a weird reaction to the title.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think it might have actually kind of drawn people to investigate the show.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. It's, like I said, it's my favorite show on TV, and I really appreciate you doing the show.
Oh, thank you.
This was a lot of fun.
Thank you for coming out here.
Of course. Obviously, you're welcome back to talk about anything else, probably not another musical, because unless it's Cats, we can do Cats.
Yes. Cats is so fun.
Thank you guys for listening. Go to stolendress.com for our other podcasts. Go to lookingforwardmovie.com for my blog-based movie that's going to run all the way through November. And as always, have a good thing. Hey everybody, welcome. This is a little addendum to episode 180. Is it 180? Let's pretend I know the number. With friend of the show, supporter of many of our projects, Rob Kuttner.
Thank you for having so many projects to support.
You're of course. Yeah, naturally. So what did you want to talk about today? You've got an awesome project out.
Well, it's my kids. No, oh, you mean about this. I have a new audio miniseries out on Howl FM,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of the Netflix of comedy podcasts.
Yeah.
Where all the WTF and Comedy Bang Bangs and like all the comedy albums are being kept
until
further notice. But they're doing some original programming, and they commissioned me to do a new audio scripted series. So a story instead of, you know, one of these sort of, you know, talk show
things that they
usually are. And it's called Runaway Brains.
So can you connect yours to Fiddler on the Roof somehow?
Well, you know all my many Gentile coworkers have said that basically my life is sort of a Fiddler on the Roof a reboot. Fiddler in the Cellar.
Everybody's in it, though.
Oh, yeah, in my show, yes.
That was
a good...
Or not in your cellar.
A good snapback.
Right.
You brought it right back to the topic. Your riddle and it's just kicked in, unlike mine. Yeah, so Runaway Brains has a really nice cast, which I was really lucky to get. Mm-hmm. The stars are Ken Jennings from Jeopardy.
That's the weirdest one.
That's the key, because...
But he's great in it.
But isn't he funny?
Yeah.
He's just really funny. Well, he's really funny on Twitter. He's so witty and like sharp and like irreverent on Twitter that I started following him a couple years ago. I was like, this guy is really funny and cool and not at all what I thought.
Right.
And I just had this idea in the back of my brain. What if Ken and Watson had to take part in the supercomputer that he fought on Jeopardy? What if they had to take part in a buddy comedy and go on the lam? And I didn't really have anything more to go on than that. And someone say I still don't.
Uh-huh.
But that's what the show is. It's that it turns out that Watson contains some deadly secrets that the government and big business want to get their hands on. And he and Watson, Ken and Watson, are forced to flee the Jeopardy set right after Final Jeopardy. And they go on this very bizarre odyssey where they go through some of the great conspiracies and strange secrets of American culture, the Freemasons and hackers and the TED Talks and Area 51, actually Area 52 and a half in this
case.
Awesome. And, they find out a lot about themselves.
Sure, hope so.
And about you.
Oh, about me specifically?
Yeah.
Oh, that's creepy. And Weird Al is the voice of Watson.
So Weird Al plays Watson, which was just like a dream come true.
And he
doesn't do any song parodies. He's just a great comic voice.
Yeah.
And he has so many, like when I recorded him, I didn't have to even tell him what to do. He just had so many great, funny ways to take his voice and just like, you know, he's just like this encyclopedia of pop culture, and he can just do anything. So he was fun. And then I have some great other people signed on, like Michael Ian Black, and David Koechner,
so good.
From Anchorman, is just a great voice too. And, Adam Pally, who's hilarious, and Lauren Lapkus, and who am I leaving out?
There's a million people.
Oh, Mayim Bialik.
Awesome.
She's fantastic. She plays an evil genius in episode two, of course. and just some other great like character actors I've worked with for years and I've always wanted to put into stuff. So
it's just been
like a party.
Yeah. So how many episodes is it?
So it's 10 episodes long.
Uh-huh.
And again, sort of going against the traditional podcast format, no offense. I wanted to do something that's just like 10-minute bites. They're all just like 10-minute radio serial episodes almost. Just so you can have just a burst of fun in your ears.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just has a 10-episode story and that's it.
Yeah. Are they all out now or are they going to be released?
God, your questions are so on point.
I know.
So it's Howl is releasing 3 episodes this week, and then they're going to do 3 next week, and then 3, and then 2. I don't know if that math adds up. Maybe it's 3, 3, 2, and 2.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
This is why I was a liberal arts major. I think it's 3, 3, 2, and 2.
Yeah.
They're doing it in batches because we do have a binge, a binge listening audience.
Yeah.
And they're going to release them every Wednesday.
Right now
they have you can sign up for Howl and get a free 1-month trial and listen to it, but also they're putting them up for free right now.
Okay.
This week on iTunes and on SoundCloud.
That's awesome.
So I assume you'll have information,
your
show links about
how to find this. Yeah, I'll definitely do that. So I think we should ask the hard questions. Which are the really bad ones?
Let's see. No. 2 through 10.
Oh, two.
I don't recommend. It's a big drop off after.
How long did it take you to write? Let's go into the details of putting it together.
Wow. It's hard to say. I spent a while on episode one just to sort of get the ball rolling. You know, the pilot's always the trickiest. I'm sure Aileen Brosh McKenna could tell you something about that.
Mm-hmm.
But so I spent a lot of time. I spent a few weeks on that one, going back and forth with Hal about how to sort of really set it up, and then I sort of had a general outline when I pitched it about like where the episodes would cover. And about what the sort of character arcs would be. And what I did was then I would just sort of, I would say each one spent me a week. That's English. I write good. You write good sometime. I would say I took about a week or so on each one. Mm-hmm. And then a few of them I wrote in a burst of feverish inspiration on a cross-country airline trip.
Awesome.
When my kids finally fell asleep and I had some scratch paper and I was feeling particularly crazy. That's probably the final ones, and you can see that there's a certain manic quality that slips into them.
Mm-hmm. I get my best writing done on airplanes. That is not a lie.
That's right.
It's
the only place to escape from the internet.
It really is the rest of the friggin' world. And you might die, so, you know, there's this panic that sets in that you don't realize.
Right. People have to see my inscrutable work written on the back of pads.
How about recording it? Sounds like it got done pretty quickly.
Yeah, so recording was, you know, just a matter of scheduling. I work with a great, mostly with a great sound recorder, and he also does the design and the mix and like all the great sound effects and stuff. A guy named Rick Sanchez at Post Ace Media, and he's out here in North Hollywood, which is very close to my office. And so I recorded most of the stars when they were around, and then a couple of people had really fancy mics because they do VO work, or a buddy with a studio. So, you know, that process also probably took about 6 or 7 weeks or something like that. And then editing actually is what, you know, takes the longest time, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
If you listen to it, you can hear it's just very tightly edited, which is all Rick's genius. And, you know, the music cues have to come in exactly at this point. And, like, this sound has to sound different than this sound. And then there's a lot of, motifs, you know, that come back when each character comes back. So there's just,
that's awesome.
That stuff took the most going back and forth, actually.
I bet. You know, it's so funny is when I started out doing this podcast 5+ friggin' years ago, people would talk to me. They're like, well, you know, comedy albums aren't really a thing anymore because, you know, podcasts are the new comedy. Well, they haven't been until the last couple years when stuff like this is happening.
Right.
Where you're actually putting together very good environmental sounds. Like listening to it, it's got just some great, great reverb in the TED talk, just little bits and pieces that I pick up on because that's the shit that I like to hear.
Right.
Just very atmospheric. Was that all him?
That was all him. I just put a note in it and say just auditorium. Mm-hmm. My favorite example of that is episode, I want to say 7, which takes place when Ken and Watson are being held captive by the International Gay Jewish Lizard Conspiracy. Spoiler. You know, that cliche has come up again.
I love it.
I may get killed for revealing the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're being held captive, and Rick says, "Where is this taking place?" And I said, "It's I'm sorry. That's when they're in a cave that is actually surrounded by rock and roll, for which reasons that you'll hear later. The episode before that, they're being held captive. They get held captive a lot. Much like my audience will. They get held captive by officials in Area 52.5 because they found out the truth. You'll see what I mean when you hear it about aliens. And Rick says, "Where is this taking place?" And I said, "It's in a prison that's underground, a government facility underground." And he's like, "That's all I told him." And I said, "Maybe it's made of cement." That's all I could think of. That's the kind of half-assed writing I tend to do. and he comes back with this thing where you can hear the reverb. You can kind of hear the stone almost, like the cold quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my favorite part. There's this drip.
Oh.
There's just this drip every few seconds. It's not even rhythmic, but it's there's a leaky pipe because it's a crappy facility in the desert. And I was like, I couldn't even ask for that.
Yeah. No, that's perfect. I like those little touches. So I'm excited to hear the whole thing. Let's see. All right. So it's best to go to Howl FM.
You're
going to get it.
Yes, because you can hear the whole thing. Hear it, I think, within this month.
Okay.
And you can hear all the other stuff they have there, too.
Awesome.
They're going to do it throughout May.
Yeah. It's so funny because my typical question would be where can I buy it? But there's not. Just get Howl and then subscribe.
Right.
And then listen to it.
Right.
And enjoy it.
I like where this is going.
Then delete it off your phone.
Yeah.
Then remember that it's there again.
Yeah, right. I like this.
Yeah. And then go back and you'll re-enjoy it in 5-6 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. At that point, maybe there'll be new more. Will you do new more? New more. Yep. Neither of us can speak English today. This is great.
If people like it, I leave it at the end with a cliffhanger.
Uh-huh.
Much as the season finale of season 2 of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend did. Where things are open-ended and there could be a whole new adventure. And otherwise, if the authorities tell me that I've revealed too much or the crazed mobs with torches say stop making these things.
Sure.
Either way, then I'll take that message. But You know, if they want to do more, we'll do a second series. That was one of those drips that came.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Not me being an unprofessional asshole and my phone going off. That's great.
I like to think of that as your software evolving.
Yeah,
like
that is also what happened. I am an Android. How did you know that? Well, you know everything. Right. I keep forgetting this.
You and Watson are cousins, actually.
I kind of hope for a crossover the next time you do one of these with Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So that, you know, you're trying to, maybe you're trying to find Josh through the whole, it'd be adorable if Ken Jennings fell in love with Josh. Ah, that'd be great. Well, thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you for having me.
Of course. Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing again.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.